actually going to do this so that I can display this on the TV, this table specifically, because I'm going to be using it and making reference to it. So that seems pretty good as far as nothing being cut off, about as big as I can go. All right. So let's get right into things. So today what we're going to be doing is looking at who's at the meeting. So we looked at the significance of the meeting, the dates for the meeting, the accounts of the meeting last week in Lesson 154. Today we want to look at who's present, all right? So we're going to get right into it. I don't really even have much of an introduction on this particular set of notes because I just want to hit the ground running. So attendees, point one. Exactly how many men attended the Hampton Court Conference is difficult to discern. So let's just stop there just for a minute. Hampton Court is the meeting that James calls amongst the Anglican bishops of the church and some Puritans to discuss church affairs. So remember a few weeks back, we talked about the millenary petition, and that was allegedly signed by 1,000 Puritan ministers and given to the king. And then we have the Hampton Court meeting. We discussed the relationship between those two things. That would be the millenary petition and Hampton Court back in Lesson 153. Then last Sunday in Lesson 154, we talked about, I introduced to you the Hampton Court meeting. We talked about the significance of the meeting, the dates for the meeting, and then the different accounts. So when I'm talking about this, and we jump right into it here in point one, I'm assuming you've seen 154. So if you're joining us right now and you didn't see 154, you're going to want to go back and get that one and probably 153. And while you're at it, get all 155 of them so that you can, you know, be up to speed with where we're at. So anyway, if you're just joining us now, you'll be able to make do here, hopefully, with that brief summary. So exactly how many men attended the Hampton Court Conference is difficult to discern. In his dissertation, The King's Own Conference, A Reassessment of Hampton Court, William Craig suggests that as many as 60 men attended the meeting. Therefore, it is safest to stick with the names of those whose attendance can be verified in the extant sources. So what do I mean by that point? Allegedly, there are some sources say there's 60, some say more than 60, some say however many. And what I'm saying is we should just limit ourselves to who we can substantiate was there from the extant sources and not speculate, all right? So there probably may have been more than the number of names here that are on this table, but we don't know for sure, and we're only going to include here on the table those people who we can substantiate were there from available sources. To that end, Timothy Burke presents the following table in his post titled Hampton Court Attendees on the King James Bible History blog. Please note that the names of the Puritan speakers are highlighted, and the names of the eventual translators are underlined. So as you look at the table, the four Puritan speakers are highlighted here in the column that says Puritan speakers. And then the name of anybody that was present at Hampton Court that ended up to be a translator on the King James Bible project, that individual's name is underlined. Okay? So the participants in the translation that were present at Hampton Court, again, they're underlined. The Puritans are highlighted. And you'll notice that of the four Puritans that were there, two of them ended up to be on the translation committee. And then there are a variety of other men who were not actually, I'm losing my train of thought there. What I'm meaning to say is there are obviously other men that are part of the translation who weren't at this meeting. So the underlining is just to show you who was at Hampton Court that ended up to be a translator. Understanding that there are more translators than those who are identified here on this table. All right. So, all told, the names of the attendees at Hampton Court who had had a hand in the creation of the King James Bible are as follows. So we've listed them out. Obviously, the first one is King James himself. Now, King James does not do any of the translation work, but is he the one that sort of signs off on the project? All right. Second would be the Bishop of London, Richard Bancroft, and then he would shortly become the Archbishop of Canterbury. So in January 1604, when this meeting is being held, Bancroft is still the Bishop of London. The next month, in February 1604, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Whitgift, is going to die, And King James is going to appoint Bancroft to be the Archbishop of Canterbury. But at the time of the meeting in January 1604, Bancroft is still the Bishop of London. He would soon become the Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, the Archbishop of Canterbury, I'm going to make it a comparison. It's not totally accurate, but it's a way for you to kind of get the point, right? In the Anglican Church, who is the head of the church? The head of the church is the king or the queen. That's the way King Henry VIII structured it when he broke away from the Roman Catholic Church and established the Church of England. The next most powerful or prestigious position in the Anglican Church is the Archbishop of Canterbury. So that's like the highest ranking church position outside of the king in the Anglican Church, right? So this guy, Bishop Bancroft, the Bishop of London, Richard Bancroft, at the time of Hampton Court, he is still only the Bishop of London. Literally the next month, the presiding Archbishop of Canterbury would die, and King James would appoint Bancroft to be the successor to that position. And we also have the Bishop of Winchester, Thomas Bilson, the Dean of Winchester, George Abbott. Later, he also is going to become an Archbishop after Bancroft. We have Dean of Westminster, Lancelot Andrews, Dean of Chester, William Barlow, who's also the guy we talked a lot about last week who took the notes on the meeting, Dean of Worcester, Richard Eads, top of page two, Dean of St. Paul's, John Overall, Dean of Christ Church, Thomas Ravis, Dean of Windsor, Giles Thompson, and then we have Lawrence Chatterton, and then we have Dr. John Reynolds. So all of those are the guys who were present at Hampton Court that had something to do with the project on the King James Bible, all right? Including the king, including Bancroft, who we'll talk a lot about in future lessons as we talk about the rules that were established for the King James translators to follow. They were largely put together by Bishop Bancroft, okay? So, regarding the four men representing the Puritan delegation in Hampton Court, so this would be Chatterton, Newstubbs, Reynolds, and Spark. So those are the four guys right here in this column who are highlighted. Burke states the following regarding these, regarding how these men should be viewed. Quote, how do we rightly think of these men? They're often referred to as the Puritan delegates or representatives, but this can in fact be a bit misleading. As this conference was taking place somewhere not far away, some 30 of the less moderate Puritans were meeting at the same time. So let that sink in. While this meeting is happening at Hampton Court, are the Puritans having their own meeting? Okay? Who had not been invited to the conference. So, and notice it says less moderate Puritans who are not invited to the conference. What does that tell you about those guys? They were more what?
Outspoken.
They were more outspoken. They were more extreme. You might say conservative, although I'm not sure that's not the way the church would have viewed them, but they were definitely in the church, in the mind of the king and in the mind of the established church, they're probably more radical. All right. They wanted more aggressive change, more wide sweeping change, and they wanted the change to come more quickly. So think about that now and understand that these guys here are basically moderate Puritans. They're not Puritans, they're not extreme Puritans, they're not Puritans that are more or less okay with the Church of England, they're moderate Puritans. Alright, let's read on. Some 30 of the less moderate Puritans were meeting at the same time who had not been invited to the conference. So again, that's an instructive point. Who does James invite to the conference? Does he invite the diehards, the radical Puritans, or does he invite what he thinks are moderate Puritans? Okay. In one of his earliest treatments of the conference, the veteran historian of Puritanism, Patrick Collison, explained, quote, not 100 miles from the Privy Council chamber at Hampton Court, at the conference but not in place, there was a gathering of some 30 ministers representing 11 counties and 4 towns. These men included Arthur Hildersham, who, as we have seen, likely drafted the millenary petition, Thomas Wilcox, Stephen Edgerton, and Henry Jacobs. They were the ones pressing upon the king for change. They had drawn up a list of instructions for the spokesman at Hampton Court to follow. Yet, as Collison concludes, this robust statement was not adequately expressed or represented by the four spokesmen who appeared for the Puritans at the conference. So according to one guy's evaluation, these four guys here did not necessarily represent the full attitude, tenor, and scope of what these Puritans actually wanted. So you got to keep that in mind as we talk about this, okay? These men had not even been allowed to decide who would be at the conference to give voice to their concerns. The king and bishops, it seems, rather most likely made this choice quite intentionally, picking some of the most moderate voices. So is the king going to allow the radical Puritans to stand in front of him and say anything?
No.
We already saw last Sunday in lesson 154 that when he announced the change of date and venue to the Hampton Court Conference because of that outbreak of plague, remember that? That was originally set for, what was it, October or November, I can't remember. It was November 1603, and then there was that outbreak of plague in London, and so they moved it to January 1604 and changed the venue to Hampton Court, right? He called that document announcing that change something about the seditious, using the word seditious to refer to the guys that wanted the change, right? So now, this delegation of four Puritans, they're moderate, and these are the four the king invites, and they're tasked to try to represent the cause of these guys here, these 30 guys that we're talking about now that are more extreme. Notice, let's go on. These hotter Puritans, especially Henry Jacobs, later complained that they had not been represented accurately at the conference. Yet this was no mistake or oversight, it was likely by design. The four men who voiced Puritan concern at the conference are thus better thought of as spokesmen than representatives or delegates. So, the understanding I have is the king's going to have this meeting. And he's like, okay, who do I want to come to represent the Puritans? He picks four to represent them that he perceives to be not on the fringe, not on the extreme, but on the more moderate end of the spectrum religiously. In any case, the two men who really shone, that means they were the primary speakers. In any case, the two men who really shone at the conference, especially on the second day, most relevant to the King James Bible, were John Reynolds, the leading Puritan spokesman, and Richard Bancroft, the ultimate anti-Puritan. So when they finally get to the topic of talking about the Bible, it's basically going to be Reynolds, the primary moderate spokesman for Puritanism, against Bancroft, the archenemy of the Puritans. Okay? Let's go to page 3. As we will see in the next lesson, when it came to the matter of the English Bible, it was Reynolds and Bancroft, should say, who squared off on opposite sides of the matter. Consequently, a bit of background and historical context is in order. So when it finally comes to it, and Reynolds says, would it please the king to allow for a new Bible? Bancroft is going to step right into that, and he's going to say, if you guys had your way, there'd be no end of translating. In other words, he was totally what? He's totally against it. So in the moment, in the decisive moment when the decision is made, there's basically going to be three voices of consequence. There's going to be the voice of Reynolds, the Puritan, who's going to suggest it. Where do you go? Right here. The other one is going to be Richard Bancroft. And then the third voice is going to be the voice of the king. Those are going to be the three decisive voices when this thing is going to come to a head as far as the Bible is concerned. Okay? Now, page 3, John Reynolds. Volumes have been written about Reynolds' background and his hand in the creation of the King James Bible. And in the interest of brevity, we will limit our comments to those provided by Timothy Berg in his summary. Guys, I have in my library, I probably have 15 books. Every book has 20 to 30 pages talking about Reynolds and all the stuff. So I think that Berg did a perfectly fabulous job of synthesizing all that stuff down to the nuts and bolts of it. And so we're just going to stick with what he says here. Knowing that, you could read a ton to your heart's content about this guy if you wanted to in other places. Okay, John Reynolds seems to have been sent to Oxford at the age of 8. Now, there's some pretty amazing stuff here. But probably he was sent back home shortly. He returned as a student in 1526, first at Merton College, then at Corpus Christi College. He came to Oxford as a Catholic, like his father and many of his family, but over the course of several years, he gradually converted to Protestantism, becoming in the late 60s a Puritan in every sense of the word, though a moderate one. So Reynolds starts off as a Catholic. He's going to eventually convert to Protestantism, and then eventually he's going to end up a moderate Puritan. So he's fully committed to the Puritan cause. He's just not willing to ask for, he's not willing to be as aggressive as some of his colleagues were. This was a status held with enough conviction that he was entrusted with tutoring the young Richard Hooker, who would go on to become perhaps the most influential theologian of the Church of England. He graduated master's degree, M.A., in 1572 and was elected Greek reader at Corpus Christi. His lectures were immensely popular, and he resigned the position in order to devote more time to the study of theology. He slowly emerged as the face of the Puritan movement at Oxford, getting caught up in a number of controversies along the way. He agitated Queen Elizabeth I on a few occasions, who saw him as a bit too extreme. He labored to refute both the Catholic Bellarmine, arguing against accepting the Apocrypha as scripture, and the eccentric controversialist Broughton. We're going to talk about him a lot more in a future lesson. With his precise and detailed chronological reading of scripture, the later fight followed him for nearly a decade. So Reynolds is sort of this moderate guy. He argues against the high church Catholic Bellarmine. He does not think the Apocrypha should be in the scripture. So he argues against Catholics, but he also is willing to argue against other Protestants on certain matters also. So he's sort of a true sense, in the true sense of the word, kind of a moderate as far as where he's at theologically and his individual beliefs and positions. In 1598, he was installed as dean and then president of Corpus Christi, a post he held until his death, greatly increasing the future of Corpus. By the time of Hampton Court Conference, he had become one of the most widely respected Puritan leaders in England. It was only natural then that he would become a kind of informal spokesman for the Puritan cause at the conference. As Mordecai Fengold notes, Reynolds' name appeared on a list of Puritan candidates that had been circulated the previous summer and autumn. When the historic occasion arrived, it was he who led the Puritan delegation. Fengold goes on to explain that Reynolds, in the midst of the controversy after the conference, proceeded that he clearly regarded as the most important project of his career and only tangible result of the Hampton Court Conference, the new translation of the Bible. So in other words, he thinks that the new Bible that they decide at Hampton Court is really the only tangible outcome and his most important project of his career. The task was divided among six groups, and Reynolds was part of the one charged with translating both the major and minor prophets. Although officially headed by John Hardy, the Regius Professor of Hebrew, the group met at Reynolds' lodgings at Corpus three times a week, a practice that continued even during the last weeks of the president's life. Joseph Hall spoke of the towering genius of Reynolds shortly after his death, saying, He alone was a well-furnished library full of faculties, full of all studies of all learning. The memory and the reading of that man was near to a miracle. Now, you gotta understand something. Back here in the late 1500s, what else is there to do? I mean, I'm saying that, you know, with all seriousness and somewhat sad about it, right? I mean, what else, if you were a learned guy like this, what else did you have to do but sit in your library and read and study? There were no distractions like, you know, modern video games and TV and internet and, you know, all this stuff that, you know, competes for our attention today. It didn't exist. So the only thing you did is you sat in your library and you read stuff and you wrote about stuff. Sounds kind of appealing to me, okay? Frankly, but, I wish I had more time to do that sort of thing, even than what I already have. So He has a library, a personal library, that he ends up donating to Corpus Christi College. Many, many, many volumes large that he's accumulated for himself that he's reading, studying, learning, etc. Okay? So, that's the first person that we need to know about. The first person is John Reynolds, the Puritan. Alright, before we move on to Bancroft, are there any questions about Reynolds?
Is that normal or is that unusual that he was in college at 13 or even before that?
Well, I would say it was way more normal then than it is now.
Sure.
I couldn't say with any sort of specificity how normal it was back then, but guys, kids who were extremely bright like this were for sure by their late teens showing up. 13 is probably still a little young even for those days. And then there's some disagreement about whether he stayed when he was that young or if he came back. But I would say it's definitely more prevalent then than it is now.
Now, the other category of deans, is that dean of schools, like head of professors? Or
so that's a great question, and I'm going to answer this off the top of my head, knowing that it's going to come up later on, okay? But what I'm going to say is bishops are church officials that are appointed by the head of the Church of England, the king. In this case, deans are also appointed by the king, but they are placed within the centers of higher learning. So they're not bishops that are overseeing churches in a parish. They are appointees of the king or the or royalty that are embedded within Oxford and Cambridge and the schools of higher learning to represent the king's sort of wishes or desires in those institutions.
But would they have kind of educational experts?
Oh yes, they are definitely extremely educated guys. They are, you know, they're primarily in the universities.
Yeah, most of the translators are deans. So.
Most of them are deans, a lot of them are deans. Yeah. So a dean is a formal academic position that you were appointed to by somebody higher up in the Church of England. And the reason for your observation is accurate, Bart. The reason why so many deans end up being translators is the thinking behind that is so the king would have those embedded in the translation process that are charged with representing his concerns. A sort of officially unofficial representatives of the king. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Okay.
Were the lawyers more political or were they just for legal?
The lawyers were truly, they were just people who were like you would think of a lawyer. They're.
Well, in today's, it seems like all the politicians.
I mean, they're political, yes. In the sense that they're supposed to represent English common law and all that sort of business, but, you know, to what degree they're conservative or liberal or whatever, by the standards of that day, is probably up for debate, and I have no expertise in what the beliefs or positions were of these guys here. So, but we do know that at least this many were there because their names show up in accounts as having been there, which is why they're on the table. All right. But I pointed this out last Sunday, and I haven't done it yet today. How many Puritans are there?
Just four.
Four. The entire rest of this structure is all slanted towards the church, the Anglican church. It's all slanted towards who? The king. And then even the four that are invited are not the most outspoken four he could have picked.
Yeah.
They're four moderate ones.
But they had instructions too, though.
They had instructions given to them, but the more radical guys that gave them the instructions feel like these four failed to accurately and adequately represent their concerns at the meeting. And it'd be easy for them to say that because basically the king gives them nothing. All the stuff they wanted, he gave them nothing. The only thing he gave them is the Bible that Reynolds flippantly asks for that was never on the millenary petition or on the agenda submitted to the king before the meeting. Okay? So again, we'll get into that next time. Let's talk about Bancroft next. So here's the second of the three key figures that are going to be involved in the decision to translate. Opposing Reynolds' suggestion for a new Bible at Hampton Court was the ambitious Bishop of London, Richard Bancroft. By January 1604, it was clear that Bancroft was well positioned to be the next Archbishop of Canterbury following the death of John Wycliffe, who died in February 1604. So I already mentioned that earlier in this lesson. So, Bancroft came to Cambridge as a slightly older man than was common in that day, but graduated Bachelor of Arts in 1567 and proceeded to masters from Jesus College in 1572. Known for his reputation in boxing, wrestling, and other competitive sports, he developed a firm, no-nonsense tone that seemed to cross over into his academic work. He was soon ordained priest in the Diocese of Ely at the age of 30. He was admitted to Doctor of Theology at Cambridge in April 1585. He curried royal favor by becoming treasurer of St. John's Cathedral by royal prerogative in 1586 and becoming a canon of Westminster in 1587. He increasingly became known as the major spokesman for conformity. So he is the chief Puritan, he's the chief Anglican guy. Don't change anything. The way things are is perfectly what? Fine. Alright? Where was I at? He increasingly became the major spokesman for conformity. He waged a battle throughout his career against Catholics on the one hand and the Puritans on the other. In his famous St. Paul's Cross sermon in 1589, which drew battle lines talked about for decades, he controversially argued against the Puritans that episcopacy, church structure built on bishops who rule in an administrative capacity over multiple churches and over other lower ministry positions grouped together into dioceses under the king as true head of the church, was not only a biblically acceptable model, it had in fact continued since apostolic times with apostolic authority as the only approved model. So is he totally in on the hierarchical church? Yep. In that sermon, he reacted sharply against the charges of the anonymous Marpolate. Bishops have had this authority, which Martin condemneth, ever since the evangelist St. Mark's times. Besides, in the most flourishing time of the church that ever happened since the apostles' days, either in respect to learning or of zeal, Martin and all his companions' opinion have herein been condemned for an heresy. Lastly, there is no living man, as I suppose, able to show where there are any such church planted ever since the apostles' time, but there the bishops had authority over the rest of the ministry. So is he definitely a high church Anglican? He almost sounds like a Catholic. The shade of difference between Catholicism and Anglicanism is not great at this point, okay? Which is the Puritan's point. The Puritan's point is, if you want to be Catholics, you might as well call yourself what? Catholics. We want more change. We want more reform. By striking association, he connected the Puritans with both modern schismatics and ancient heretics, condemning them all alike as those who, quote, by schism and heresy divided themselves from the Church of God and rent in sunder by their factions the peace thereof. So, is Bancroft totally against the Puritans? Okay. Beyond just Martin, Cranfield explains Bancroft's homily had another intended target. Those who exalted the Word of God to the point that it became the sole authority, that by preaching and prophesying threatened the balance within the church to set greater store up by the use of sacraments. So is he against any principle that would have been scripture only? Mm-hmm. Okay? So this all starts making sense, right? So why, here you have a guy in Bancroft. He hates the Puritans. He doesn't like them. He is against the principle of sola scriptura. He thinks the church hierarchy and structure is necessary. So when Reynolds, the chief speaker from the Puritan delegation, brings up the idea of a new Bible, who chimes up and says, we don't need that? It's Bancroft. Okay? These he denounced as false prophets. While some reformers were proposing the principle of sola scriptura, arguing that every man, even those not ordained and trained in the church, had a right to read the scripture for themselves, Bancroft denounced them as missing the Augustinian principle that, quote, faithful ignorance is better than rash knowledge. Indeed, it falleth not within the compass of every man's understanding to determine and judge in matters of religion, but of those who are well experienced and exercised in them. So is he against the idea of sola scriptura and the common man being able to decide things for him or herself out of their own Bible? Does he view the hierarchy as necessary? As Cranfield insightfully recognizes, Erasmus and Tyndale had hoped the plowboy in the field would each have the scriptures to read for themselves, but for Bancroft, such democratized readers would only become, in his words, quote, the prattling old woman, the doting old man, the brabbling sophiter. They think they are understanding scripture by reading it, but since they do so without the aid of the ordained bishop, they actually tear it in pieces and take upon them to teach it before they have learned it. He had little interest in such plowboys reading scriptures for themselves. So, is Bancroft... I mean, I read Bancroft's comments and he sounds like a Catholic to me. There's not much difference. Okay? So that shows you how close, at the time, at the back here, late 1500s, early 1600s, it shows you how close the Anglican Church was to Catholicism. And it shows you why the Puritans, do they want more change? Okay? Any questions?
Basically, they just said, no pope, we just have the Archbishop of Canterbury. They just replaced a title.
In many ways, that's all they did, and I think they allowed them to marry.
Oh, okay.
The bishops to marry and stuff like that. But other than that, structure-wise, hierarchically, it's basically the same stuff. So, Bishop Bancroft was a staunch defender of the political religious status quo within the Anglican Church, earning him the title of, quote, the arch anti-Puritan. Bancroft's ministry was largely marked by the campaign against Puritanism and a related defense of the episcopacy. In 1597, Bancroft assumed the role of Bishop of London, increasing his reach. While he maintained some personal friendship of the more moderate Puritans, he was, as Collison terms it, quote, the arch anti-Puritan. Nowhere does this become more clear than in his actions and comments at the Hampton Court Conference. He immediately opposed a suggestion for a new translation, and yet, as we will see soon, placed by the king as head over the entire project of creating it. This is an absolutely fascinating thing. He opposes it immediately, and he ends up to be the guy that largely guides it. Okay? Why would that be? Because he's politically shrewd, and he's representing the interests of the king. And does the king still want this Bible to turn out to favor the episcopacy over the Puritans? Okay, let's go on. Alistair McGrath suggests that part of the reason for this reversal must have been because he saw the importance of protecting the interests of the church from both Catholics and Puritans. His position of oversight would further allow him the right of limiting the translators in their freedom. Bancroft had realized that it was better to create a new official translation than he could influence than to have to contend with the authorization of the Geneva Bible. It was decisively the lesser of two evils. He was in a position to exercise considerable influence over the New Bible by laying down rules of translation that would ensure that it would be sympathetic to the position and sensitivities of the established Church of England. Now listen. There are some King James advocates or King James only believers who are going to hear this and they're going to lose their full mind. Because they don't like to think of the fact that the King James Bible is a pro-high church Bible. But the reality is, guys, that at the end of the day, when you evaluate all the data and everything that happens, it ends up to be very much that way. Okay, now, I'm not prepared to show you all the reasons for that. That's partly what we're going to be flushing out over the next few lessons. But what Alistair McGrath is saying here in this quote is absolutely true. So when Bancroft now is going to set the rules for this new Bible, what is rule number one? Rule number one is to follow the bishop's Bible unless the truth of the original says otherwise. Why would the Archbishop of Canterbury set rule number one to follow the bishop's Bible? Because it's the Bible he supports. And by doing that, can he ensure that it is as much pro the Bible he wants as anything else is going to be? You guys following this? Okay. Now, I have books at home. I've talked to you about this before. Of leading lights in the King James only movement who say it's a Catholic folktale that they followed the bishop's Bible. Meanwhile, there's a document in the Bodleian Library in England called Bod 1602, which is a 1602 bishop's Bible that has the handwritten notes of the translators in the margin. Did they follow rule one? You bet your heiny ho they followed rule number one. They absolutely followed rule number one. There's a mountain and a pile of evidence that they followed rule number one. Who came up with rule number one? Bancroft. So, he was in a position to exercise considerable influence over the New Bible by laying down rules of translation that would ensure that it would be sympathetic to the position and sensitivities of the established Church of England. And finally, he would be in a position to review the final text of the translation in case it needed any judicious changes before publication. A final reason was significant to his thinking, likely further motivated this reversal. That is, his own career ambitions, as Alistair McGrath goes on to explain. To support the new translation would be to win royal favor. Which, if the ailing Archbishop of Canterbury died in February, shortly after the conclusion of the Hampton Court Conference. His successor would be appointed from among the present bench of bishops. Bancroft was the front runner for preferment. Yet promotion lay at the king's gift precisely because of the royal supremacy that Bancroft so persuasively espoused. From February onward, Bancroft knew that he had no option if he wanted to secure the See of Canterbury. He would have to make sure the king's new translation project went ahead smoothly, whatever his personal views on the matter. Bancroft was politically on the rise with an eye sharply upon the archbishop's chair, a role which he likely assumed unofficially behind the scenes before which it passed. If his plan was to use the new translation to please the king in order to firmly secure his coveted see, it worked. He was formally confirmed as Archbishop of Canterbury on the 10th of December, 1604. He was then able to more thoroughly, quote, reconstruct the English church from a place of power in the phrase that shaped Usher's classic title. So, Bishop Bancroft, he opposes it, yet he ends up being the guy that writes the rules for the project. Alright, so I'm sure you might have questions there. Before we move on to King James, anybody have any questions? Now, you see what I was saying a few weeks ago? The way I've always heard this taught, the way I've almost always read it in books, pro-King James books is Millenary Petition, Hampton Court, King James Bible. Like, it's just this neat and tidy little thing that happened, right? The reality of it is that it is not that way at all. And there are things happening for reasons that you're not going to know unless you really look behind what's happening to try to understand it, okay? So, we've got Reynolds. We've looked at Bancroft. Now I want to look at some more things regarding James. Before we talk about James, though, does anybody have any questions or comments about anything so far? We've got about 20 minutes to talk about James. Yeah.
Given the PC and maybe it's an assumption on my part, the fluidness of the different people involved in this court, why wouldn't the Geneva Bible be just as credible, seeing it was written by the Puritans?
Nope. The reason it wouldn't is because of James. James hated the Geneva Bible. Remember we talked about this before, Ken? The reason he hated the Geneva Bible is because there were marginal notes in the Geneva Bible that he viewed as seditious and undermining divine right of kings.
Right. But from the perspective of
so you're
Protestant.
From the perspective of these guys, yes, I will agree. In fact, I will go so far as to say that when Reynolds floats the idea of a new Bible, he didn't really mean it. What he really wanted was for the king to approve the Geneva Bible for reading in the church service. Now, why would I say that? I'll show you next Sunday that in his request for a new Bible, he cites three passages from the Great Bible that he viewed as improperly translated. And then in the recommendations that he makes for correcting them, he provides the three readings he provides to correct them are three readings from the Geneva Bible. That's what Reynolds says. There is no doubt in my mind that when Reynolds is asked, what he's really asking for is for the king to agree to allow for the Geneva Bible to be sanctioned officially by the church. But James was not going to have any of that. And like I've already alluded to, James already has his own thinking about this whole thing before this meeting ever starts. Okay? So, I'll say three things. From the point of view of the Puritans, I think their intention the entire time, even by asking for a new translation, was to simply allow for the, was to have the king sanction the Geneva Bible. I think that's really what they wanted. Would that have been way easier than going through this long, drawn-out process of redoing it? Okay? So, Bancroft sees an opportunity here for him to curry favor with the king, and if this is going to happen like James wants it to, then he's going to make sure that it happens in a way that it ends up to be the most favorable towards the Anglican Church. Okay? Meanwhile, James has all this thinking about what's going on here that we need to kind of look at now. Okay? So I think I answered your question. Okay, good. King James, page 6. Of the attendees of Hampton Court, King James was by far the most important figure. After all, he is the reason for the meeting in the first place. King James I himself was, of course, the most important attendee of the conference. He appointed himself moderator. Everything that happened was ultimately centered around him. And all final decisions were his. It was, as Craig terms it in the title of his dissertation, the king's own conference. James was in control in every way someone could be. Finchman explains that, quote, all in all, this was a singularly unusual conference dominated by the king, who acted at different times as prosecutor, witness, judge, and jury, and used the discussions to demonstrate his theological learning and caustic wit. James kind of got off on this stuff. He enjoyed entering into these church arguments. and showing everybody. Remember, we went back and I taught that whole lesson on James's youth and how he was taught growing up and how the Bible and theology and all this stuff played a role in his early education and all that stuff. Why? Because it all that stuff bears on what's going on here. Okay? We have examined already some of the details of the life of James and his rise to the English throne. It suffices here to note that while the circumstances that he came from Presbyterian Scotland likely gave the Puritans some hope that they would find favor in his eyes, his actual history fighting the Presbyterians in his first kingdom made virtually the exact opposite the case, at least at first. He was committed to episcopacy as anyone else in the English church because of how it bolstered his own ideas of divine right of kings. Why wouldn't he want it? If he believes he's ruling by divine right, does it fill him with all gleefulness to be able to sit on the head of the Church of England? Why is he going to say now, oh, you Puritans are right, I have too much power? I mean, give me a break. He's not going to do that. He was thus less interested in moving the church in a Puritan direction than he was in dealing with what he saw as a pesky problem that needed preemptive strike to bring a peaceful resolution. James doesn't really care about their grievances. He wants to put them in their place. He wants to say, I am now the king and you will do what I say. Okay? While he would come later to a more balanced perspective on Puritans and at least some of their demands, they had the misfortune of appearing at the conference, in his eyes at least, to be yet another manifestation of the obstacles to his power raised by Presbyterians in Scotland like Andrew Melville. As Jenny Warmald explained, the conference, that he was too early in the reign to produce the positive results the Puritan spokesman wanted. Now understand, remember we talked about this before in lesson 152 about how James was always fighting with the Scottish Kirk until he got old enough to basically put them in their place, right? Remember we talked about that in lesson 152? So now James shows up in England, it's still within the first year of his reign, and how does he view all these Puritans? He views them the same way he viewed those Scottish Kirk guys that were trying to tell him what to do when he was King of Scotland. James was challenging hardline Elizabethan attitudes too soon for success. And he had not yet fully realized how different from his Scottish Presbyterians were the English Puritans he met at Hampton Court. Hence his furious and famous outburst, "No bishop, no king," in the heat of the debate. He was surely seeing not John Reynolds as his associates, moderate men all, but in response to Reynolds' unlucky use of the word presbytery, seeing Andrew Melville and his extreme supporters. Hence his lack of opposition to Bancroft's extensive deprivations of Puritan clerics in 1605-1606, deprivation was a weapon he used in Scotland himself. Nevertheless, Hampton Court was a landmark of importance if not intermediate term. The presence of these three men, James, Reynolds, and Bancroft at the Hampton Court Conference would end up profoundly shaping the final product. The King James Bible ended up being caught in the middle of an ecclesiastical tug of war. Reynolds and the Puritans he spoke for pulled the translation from one direction, representing Puritan interests, while Bancroft, with much more power, pulled it another, directly opposing those interests and supporting episcopacy. James controlled it all, ensuring that Bancroft had the final decisions. It would end up being Bancroft's Bible far more than it would Reynolds. And that, as we will see, made all the difference in the end. Okay, so we have a few minutes if anybody has any questions or comments. Most of the time, people think that, you know, everyone just knew, and God was somehow pulling all the strings and mystical hoodly-doo and all the stuff going on, and out pops the King James Bible in 1611, and the whole English world is like, finally, God's word in our language. No, that is not at all what happened. Okay, and even, we'll study this, and even when it finally came out, who do you think didn't like it? The Puritans. They hated it. At first, a lot of them did. Now, I may have overstated that. I don't think all of them hated it, but there was those radical ones surely did not like it. And even when you get into like the 1650s during the English Civil War, the Puritans eventually take control. They cut the king's head off and they take control of the government of England. What Bible do you think they made the official Bible in England when they got control over things? Not the King James, the Geneva Bible. And it wasn't until the restoration of the monarchy after the English Civil War that that whole thing sort of settled out and the King James became the standard English text. But it was not at all that way immediately following the publication of the King James Bible in 1611. It was still a hotly debated political deal. Okay? So we're almost out of time, though. Does anybody have any questions or comments?
Is there any truth to the rumor that William Shakespeare had any
involvement? Shakespeare had no involvement in the King James Bible translation process. To my knowledge, all of Shakespeare's quotes from the Bible or scriptural allusions in his plays came from the Geneva Bible. Now, this is the age of Shakespeare. Shakespeare is writing plays and they're you know, staging his plays at this time, but he's not directly involved in that part of it.
Well, I have always heard it. He made it more readable for the general public, but I don't know if he translated anything.
That is not true. I would say that's not true. Shakespeare was not one of the translators. And I have there's no evidence that I know of to suggest that he was brought in to review anything, or that any change was made to the text based upon Shakespeare's input.
But the translators probably read Shakespeare, were familiar with Shakespeare's work, and that could have had some.
So I think that's a different thing. I think they were Shakespeareans in the sense that they were reared in a culture that valued the theater. Okay? And so they had an ear that was tuned to how things sounded when they were read out loud.
Yeah.
Okay? So the final one of the final things they did in the final translation process is somebody would stand at a lectern similar to I am right now and they would just read the text out loud. And then if somebody objected to the way something sounded when it was read, they would raise their hand and then they would talk about that. But so that's that type of aural voice for how things would sound audibly when they're read out loud would be Shakespearean in that sense. But Shakespeare's not involved in any of the actual translation. But the guys were aware of that and they were concerned with it to a degree as they went about doing this for how this Bible would sound when it was read out loud in church.
Yeah.
They wanted it to sound majestic.
Because it seems I've heard that the previous Bibles were kind of stilted when you tried to read them. They didn't sound, they didn't flow. At some points, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that part of what the translators did is they smoothed out those English language issues in the translation of the King James.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Was there any opposing to his plays because of the Geneva Bible quotes in it?
Not that I know of. I mean, I'm sure he was opposed for other reasons. Probably there were people that thought the plays were too worldly and, you know, this and that. You know, probably a lot of the Puritans didn't like his plays because they thought they were carnal or something like that. But the point is, when you think about the Renaissance, The Italian Renaissance is known for its great artists, right? Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, Raphael, you know, all the Ninja Turtles, okay? and so it's known that the Italian Renaissance or the Southern Renaissance is known for its painting and sculpting and architecture. The Northern Renaissance on the continent, you have the great Northern German painters, the Finnish painters and all these guys. But when you think about the English Renaissance is known for its literature. And primarily at the top of the list is Shakespeare. So all these translators that are involved in this process are Shakespearean in that they're in the age of Shakespeare. They're doing the work during the time frame when Shakespeare is writing his plays. And a lot is happening in the English language in terms of literature. So the King James Bible does come out as sort of the peak point of the English Renaissance in terms of literature, which is why it has had such an enduring quality, you know, all the way through till now, more than 400 years later. So anyway, those were just random. Anybody else have a question?
Was the only purpose of this conference for the Bible?
No. This conference had, the original point of this conference had nothing to do with the Bible at all. Remember, the Bible was not mentioned on the millenary petition, and it was nowhere mentioned in the documents presented to the king or submitted to the king before the meeting. Reynolds, and we'll talk about this next Sunday, on the second day, the king has basically beat the Puritans into the ground. And it's almost like this final desperation that Reynolds even brings it up. In fact, some of the biographies about this and stuff that had been written, one guy describes the request for the new Bible as, quote, with all the lightness of an afterthought.
Did anything else get accomplished?
Well, it depends who you're talking to. If you're talking to James and the Anglicans, a whole lot got accomplished because basically their entire system remained absolutely intact without any change. But the Bible, why this Bible? Why would James, who's basically shut down the entire Puritan agenda on a flippant afterthought type comment by Reynolds, say, let's do that?
Drive it home.
There has to be a reason why he would do that. Okay? And I think I know the reason, but you'll have to come next week. Okay? All right. Seriously, now it's 10. We need to quit. I'm going to end this live stream. Thanks for those of you that have joined us. And we will move on. And if you have a question and you want to ask it, stay after. I need to pick up this equipment. See you next week.